Let me ask you a question, and it goes along with the song that we were just singing and the scripture that Brother Jeff read a few moments ago. Have you ever been lost before? Isn't that a terrible feeling? One of my earliest memories is a time when I was lost. I was only 3 years old, and I was walking with my parents in Mercer Mall in Bluefield, West Virginia, and apparently I was just a couple of steps in front of them, so they tell me. And as I walked, they saw something out of the corner of their eye, and they turned to just look at it, but little Mike just kept on walking. And the memory kicks in when I look up, turn around, and realize that my parents are not there. And I realized I was lost, and I was terrified. And I can just remember letting out this blood-curdling scream in the middle of the mall, and the whole mall comes to a stop to just look at this little three-year-old boy who was lost and couldn't find his parents. Of course, as the story goes, my parents heard me crying from two stores down and immediately left whatever they were looking for and came and found me. And of course, I don't remember anything after that. But I do remember what it felt like when I was lost. You ever been in danger before? I mean real danger. In threat of your life. I remember I was an excellent swimmer in high school. I was a surfer, spent a lot of time in the ocean, but a friend and I went out to the ocean one day, and we shouldn't have been out there. You know, being dumb teenage boys, we thought, we'll be fine. And so as I was out there, I got caught in the strongest rip current that I've ever felt. And it began to not only pull me out, but it began to pull me under the water. And I did what I could to swim against it and fight against it. And finally, there was a set of jetties that came out from the beach. And it was pushing towards these giant rocks. And these six-foot waves are crashing down on the rocks. And I remember thinking, I'm going to die. I knew that I was in danger. I knew that I was in trouble. And I began to do the only thing that I could do, just let the current push me towards the jetties and just hope that I caught it at just the right time when I would go up on the rock. And fortunately, it wasn't one of the bigger swells. It was more of a medium swell. And it just sort of pushed me, sort of like Jonah being spit out on the beach by the fish, I guess. I was just laid up onto one of these rocks. And I laid there for probably 20 minutes, just thankful to God that I had been spared that day. I was in real danger. Just like before, I was really lost. You know, when I look out at the world that you and I live in today and I think about the spiritual condition of people, I think we all have to admit, and I'm not saying that this is the case everywhere, I do believe that people are looking for the Lord. I believe that. Otherwise, I think He would have came back already. But the reality is, people just aren't in large numbers looking for God right now. And going along with that, you look at people's spiritual condition and you see a few things. Number one, most people don't feel like spiritually they are lost. They don't feel like they are lost in some spiritual sense. Furthermore, most people don't realize that they are in danger. They don't realize that God's wrath has been poured out against the sin of man, and the only umbrella of salvation is in Jesus Christ. They don't feel like they are in danger. Furthermore, they question all sense of authority, it seems like nowadays. They question the GPS. You know, wives, do you have a husband like me that does that occasionally when the GPS says turn right and you're like, nah, I know a faster way. Oh, the traffic won't be that bad. Right? And then you go the way that you think it needs to go, and red lights, right? Turns out I didn't know where I was going in the way that I thought I did. Well, people are questioning all sense of authority, and they're questioning the Bible as a source of authority. It's telling them that they're lost. It's telling them that they're in danger. Maybe Christians, the church is telling folks, hey, you're lost. They just don't believe it. You know, we talked a little bit about this last Sunday night when I was talking about the hard teachings of Jesus. But Jesus taught in parables. And He taught in the way that He did to get the people in the world to wake up. He taught them in such a way that either people got what He was saying or they didn't. But the people that got what he was saying, it radically changed their life, and it radically hardened those people, even to the point that they killed him who didn't get what he was saying. You've probably heard this definition of a parable before, that a parable is a spiritual truth that is cloaked or conveyed in earthly stories. And the reality is, these parables were often very simple. They were so simple that a child could understand them. In fact, just to test this, and this is sort of funny, I asked my daughter, Meredith, this morning on the way to church about the particular parable, the prodigal son, that I'm preaching on this morning. I said, Meredith, what's the point of the prodigal son? And you know what? She gave me a very adult answer. And I chuckle at that because part of me, I was like, I'm very proud. But I really don't like the fact she's growing up. I just don't like that. But she told me what the parable of the prodigal son was, because she knows her Bible and she's been taught it growing up. But my point in asking her was to test what I thought was true, and I think it certainly is, that the parables of Jesus aren't hard to understand. Even a child can understand the parables of Jesus. And yet, even the most mature Christian who's been studying the Bible their whole life would tell you that they have more to glean in studying the spiritual truths that are found in these parables. And here's an interesting thing, and this is where it connects in with what we're talking about today. In a lot of those parables that Jesus preached, he talked about being lost. He talked about people being in danger. And he talked about people being found. You kind of get, when you read these parables of Jesus, like those that are recorded in Luke chapter 15, that's what was on the heart of Jesus. As he interacted with these people, as he taught these people, that's what was important to Jesus. That people understood that they were lost and outside of that relationship with God the Father. But he also wanted them to know that they could be found. That God the Father was seeking them like a lost sheep or like a lost coin. He was looking for them diligently because he cared for them and he wanted them to be found. And so in this morning's sermon, we're going to examine what is perhaps one of the most famous of all these such parables, and that is the parable of the prodigal son. I invite you this morning to turn your Bible to Luke chapter 15, verses 11 through 32. We will read that in just a moment. Luke chapter 15, verses 11 through 32. We're going to examine this parable, and we're going to do it by reading the parable, and then we're going to look at each of the main characters, of which I'm going to say to you this morning there are three. And if we listen to this classic story of lostness, this classic account of someone being found, we will learn something about humanity's own lostness, what it takes to be found, but more importantly, I think we will learn about the heart of God, our Father. And so I've actually sort of, play on words, titled this sermon, The Prodigal's Father. Because oftentimes, even when we title it in the book, we title it The Prodigal Son, or The Parable of the Prodigal Son, which I want to push back on that narrative right away and tell you I think there are two prodigal sons in this particular parable, and I'll explain that in a moment. But really, at the heart of this, it's not just about the one who went away. It's about the father who received him back. And it's a parable that's designed, yes, to teach you about the reality of your life, but it's also, and most importantly, I think, a parable that's designed to teach you about God, about your Father who is in heaven. And I hope that's what we can get today out of this. If we will study and listen to this, we will learn about being lost, we will learn about being found, but we will learn essential truths that every single human being needs to know about God. So let's take an opportunity and read the parable together. Luke chapter 15, beginning in verse 11. I'm reading from the New American Standard 95. It says, "And he said, a man had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me.' And so he divided his wealth between them. And not many days later, the younger son gathered everything together and went on a journey into a distant country. And there he squandered his estate with loose living. Now when he had spent everything, a severe famine occurred in that country, and he began to be impoverished. So he went and he hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, and he sent him into his field to feed the swine. And he would have gladly filled his stomach with the pods that the swine were eating, and no one was giving anything to him. But when he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread? But I am dying here with hunger. I will get up and go to my father, and I will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men.' So he got up and he came to his father, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and he felt compassion for him, and he ran and embraced him and kissed him. And he said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his slaves, 'Quickly, bring out the best robe, put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet. And bring the fattened calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead, and he's come to life again. He was lost, and he's been found.' And they began to celebrate. Now his older son was in the field. And when he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. And he summoned one of the servants and began inquiring, 'What are these things and what could they be?' And he said to him, 'Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has received him back safe and sound.' But he became angry and was not willing to go in. And his father came out and began pleading with him. But he answered and said to his father, 'Look, for so many years I've been serving you, and I have never neglected a command of yours. And yet you have never given me a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has devoured your wealth with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him.' And he said to him, 'Son, you've always been with me, and all that is mine is yours. But we had to celebrate and rejoice, for this brother of yours was dead, and he has begun to live, and was lost, and he has been found.'" And so as I said, as I was introducing this particular sermon this morning, the way that we're going to approach this is we're going to look at, as I see it, the three main characters of this particular account of the parable of the lost sons, I would call it, the prodigal sons. And often when we look at this particular parable, our focus tends to be on these two main characters, the prodigal son, the one who took his inheritance and went off and spent it and returned to his father, and then also on the father. But we don't give much attention to the son that was older, the son that stayed. And I think attention needs to be given to this particular son. And especially we need to be paying attention to what the father says to him. So if you would please go to the end of the parable that we just read, and let's first consider the other prodigal. Point one. I've simply called this the other prodigal. And let's take just a moment and scan through the text, and let's examine from the scriptures what Jesus says in this parable about this particular prodigal. First of all, he was distant. Notice that it says in verses 26 and 27 that he was in the field and he was working in his father's property. And yet when he came back, he didn't go into the feast. He sort of stayed at a distance, and instead he sent one of the servants to go in and inquire of the events instead of attending. And when he found out the reasons for the celebration that his son, or rather his brother, had come home, instead of rejoicing like the father rejoiced, this particular son became immediately angry when he learned that this brother of his who had squandered his father's wealth with loose living had came back. And it says that in his heart, He became very angry and indignant. And then he does this. He refuses to go in. Did you notice that in the parable? Instead of going in and confronting the father in the feast or going in, he still keeps the father and he keeps his brother at a distance and he refuses to go in. And so in his jealous anger of the things that were happening, he refuses to go into the feast, verse 28. And then I want you to notice verse 29, because I think this gets to this son's heart. Verse 29, I want to read it again. It says, he says to the father, "Look, for so many years I have been serving you, and I have never neglected a command of yours, and yet you have never given me a young goat so that I might celebrate with friends." Notice where what he bases this relationship with the father. You may not have ever noticed this before, but the father went out to each of the sons. To the one son who was coming back, the father ran to him. To the one son who was indignant and kept everything at a distance, the father had to leave the feast and the rejoicing to come out and address this rebellious son who wouldn't even come in. And the father says to him, or rather he says to the father, "Look at all that I have done." In essence, he measures the relationship of him and his father based on his merits, on how good of a son he had been. And then he judges his value based on the merits of others in the very next verse. "But when this son of yours," verse 30 says, "who devoured your wealth and prostitutes came, you killed the fattened calf for him." Now what has he done? He's not comparing himself to the father. He's not comparing himself to the father's love. He's comparing himself to his brother who ran away and spent all his money on loose living. You know, it doesn't get said often, and this is the part that I think church folks need to just listen to very carefully. It doesn't get said often, but just being in the Father's house didn't mean that this man was saved. Just being in the Father's presence, just being in the Father's house didn't mean that this man's heart was right. In fact, there's every indication in the text that that just because he was close to the father and hadn't ran off and spent all of his father's wealth on loose living, that his heart was right. And that begs me to ask a few questions about this particular son that I think sometimes we overlook. Questions that are probing and challenging, and maybe they're as challenging for you as they were for me. As I thought about these things, like, we may be in the Father's house, but is God close to us? Are we close with the Father? Do we have a relationship with the Father? Are we allowing negative feelings towards other people to affect our relationship with God? Are we determining our value? Are we determining our self-worth based on the actions and the feelings of others? Or are we determining our self-worth and value based on the Father? In other words, am I looking out at people? Am I looking at the way others live? And am I judging my relationship to God based on how good I am compared to them? Am I looking at God and am I still have these scales of justice where I feel like my relationship with God is if I just do enough good, I can tip the scales in my favor to outweigh the sin and the negative in my life? And if I just tip the scales in my favor and do enough good, the Father will accept me? Is that how we feel? You know, I think it's very possible a person could feel as if they are saved and yet be lost. And the real reflection of their lostness and the real reflection of the danger they have of being lost is seen in the fact that they are judging their value based on others. They're trying to tip the scales in their favor instead of resting in the Father's house. Instead of resting and trusting in the faith, or rather in the grace and love of God. And in every way, I would tell you, in every way when a person is like this, they mimic the same heart, the same rebellious heart of the prodigal who ran away. That same rebellious heart that said, I'm going to just go do it my way, is the same heart of the person that tries to judge their relationship with God based on their own merits. Because it all depends on them and not upon the Father. And that leads me to the second son, the one that we usually talk about, and that is the prodigal son. And the idea of being a prodigal is the idea of wasteful spending or loose spending habits. And somebody says, well, hang on, Mike, how do you call the first son a prodigal? Well, it's because I think he was wasting his time in the father's house. All those years that he spent working in the father's field and enjoying the father's food, and yet his heart had never truly been changed. In that sense, spiritually, he was a prodigal. But this particular son, the second son that I want to talk about, is truly a prodigal. Because he did take his father's inheritance and he did go off into a foreign country and he did spend it on lavish and excessive lifestyles. And while it's true the younger son did waste his inheritance, what he really was wasting was his life. And for those people that are out there in that far country of sin that we often call the world, that's really the sad thing. All the time that they spend out there in the world, all the time that they spend on their sinful living, all the time they spend out there living for themselves, they're wasting the life that God has given them to glorify Him in the life that they've given. They're wasting the purpose for which they have been created. They're not just wasting the Father's blessings, they're literally wasting the purpose of their life. And so as we seek to examine this particular brother, we see that he went out and he wasted his life on what he supposed, I guess, were greener pastures. You know, the Bible does say that sin has its pleasure for a season. Let's not pretend that that's not true, because it is. That far country of sin can seem fun. It can seem pleasurable. It can seem nice for a period of time, and it certainly did, according to verse 13, to the prodigal who went out. And he went out and wasted his life on sinful pleasures, only to realize and find out at the end there of verse 13 that they do not completely satisfy. As hard as you might try, and as hard as Solomon, read the book of Ecclesiastes, as hard as we might try, no amount of pleasure, no amount of sin can completely fill the hole that is only there in our hearts to be filled by God. Furthermore, he wasted his life, and then what he found out was he had no support when the hard times came. You see, he had the father's support, and he thought, I want to go out on my own, and I want to waste it on this sinful living. And he had friends for a season. Isn't that the way it works? In the world, we have sin, or we have friends when we're in that sinful state for a season. But when the hard times come, and when difficulties fall upon us, how many people have found themselves like the prodigal? Nobody to turn to. Where now all they've become is a slave. That's all that they've become. Is a slave to their sin, and they have nothing to do but to turn to others and to beg for their assistance and to their help. You know, I think the most important verse, as far as it pertains to us, in our relationship to God, the most important verse, as I've studied this over and over again, as it relates to our relationship with God, is verse 17. Put your eyeballs on it this morning. Look at it. Here's what everybody needs. Verse 17. I don't know what translation you have, but mine says it this way. But when he came to his senses, that's what you need. He came to his senses. He had a mental awakening. He realized that he was wasting his life. He realized that he had left the father's house. He realized that the father was still who he was. He came to his senses, and that's when the change began. Notice he struggled, verses 18 and 19, with self-image. And that's what happens when you live in that far country of sin, and it all comes to nothing. You struggle with self-image. You struggle with guilt. You struggle with, will God ever accept me back? Can He ever love me? How many people are staying in the world, they're staying in that far country of sin this morning, all because they just don't feel like, in their guilt, that God would ever accept them back? And He's wrestling with that in verses 18 and 19. You see it in His prepared speech. It's so sad. It really is. He says, Father, I will get up and go to my Father, and I'll say to Him, Father, I've sinned against heaven in Your sight. Now notice the way he looks at himself now. I'm no longer worthy. I'm no longer worthy to be called Your son. Just make me a hired man. You see, he thought, and maybe this is why so many people just won't come back to the Father. He thought that the way he was going to be treated in the Father's house was the same way he was being treated in that far country of sin. He thought that, you know, that's all his life was now. How many people won't come into the church because they feel like when they come in here, they're just going to be treated like they were out there? They're going to be judged. They're going to be marginalized. They're going to be pushed aside. Now, how many of us might treat people that way? We see the people that are out in the world. We see the sin and the gross sins that's going on out there in the world. And we think, that's wrong. The world, man, look what's going on in the world. We need to get away from this. This is terrible. And it becomes this sort of us versus them mindset. What happens if they actually come through those doors? And they sit right there on those pews. How do we treat them? See, this prodigal, he just struggled with self-image. But notice verse 7. Verses 20 through 21. He didn't even make it to the Father's house. All of that self-talk, all of that self-imaging problem that he had because of his time in the far country of sin, it was not true. Because instead, as he's going up the path, his Father sees him, and this is the only time in the Bible that God is said to run. When he runs out to the prodigal who's returning, and he meets him on the way. He didn't even make it to the Father. He didn't even finish his speech before God met him and welcomed him back. You know, as we think about this particular prodigal, we ask these questions. Is that far country of sin really all that good? You know, the world does a good job when they put the billboards up of the beer signs and all of that sort of stuff, you know, of making it. You never see an alcoholic and all of the downfall of that on one of those signs. You just don't see it. And that's just a reminder of me of the spiritual battle that's out there. The devil works really hard at making sin look fun. He does a good job of making sin look entertaining. He doesn't do a very good job at all of, and not that he would want to, of telling us the actual effects of sin. You know, what has a person really gained if they spend their whole life in that far country of sin just to die in the pig pen? What value has their life been? If all that their legacy is that they lived in that far country of sin apart from the Father's house. And then the question that I ask myself is, what will it take for a person to come to their senses? What would it take for a person to come to their senses and realize that they are lost and they are in danger and they need to come back to the Father? You know, if you're not in the Father's house, then you're in that far country of sin. And the invitation is, we need to come to our senses. Just like the boy that was in his Father's house needed to come to his senses and realize that his relationship with the Father wasn't right, How many people are out there in this world today? There's billions of them that need to come to their senses and realize they're in danger and return to the Father. And that leads me to my third and final character that I'd like to focus on the rest of my time this morning. That is the prodigal's father. The reaction to the father's, or rather the reaction of the father to the boys, seems to be, to me at least, the central point of this parable. Again, going back to the idea that the reason we have this parable is to teach us about God. And as we seek to examine this father and the way that he responded to his two sons, what do we see? Well, number one, notice the father didn't prevent the younger son from leaving. I'm sure there were some conversations that the father had with the younger son. Don't go do this. This isn't in your best interest. But notice the father was willing to allow his younger son to go out and make his mistakes. Ultimately, the father gave him his inheritance and let the boy go out to learn his lessons. He didn't go to the far country of sin looking for the boy. He didn't go out and abdicate his responsibilities as his house. He didn't go out and enable the boy's sin. He stayed in the house because he knows that his character has left an indelible impression upon the boy. Right? He knows that he has modeled the best father that he can be. He doesn't go to that far country looking for the boy. And he was remembered. I think this is so important for us to keep in mind. He was remembered by the younger son for his kindness to his servants. Did you catch that? As the younger son is wrestling with his self-image, he says, "How many of the servants in my father's house have much to eat, basically, and are taken care of?" You know what that says? The boy remembered the kind of person his father was. And then as the boy returned, verse 20 says, the father felt compassion for him. How important is it? It's incalculable. Incalculable. Sorry, I can't get my words out this morning. It's immeasurable. How about that? How important it is that we get that. That the father's first reaction is not finger waving. The father's not first reaction is, "You did this and you're going to earn it back. You're going to pay back every dime that you wasted." The father's first reaction wasn't, "You hurt me. You hurt your whole family. You embarrassed us. You shamed us." Church, what is the father's first response when the boy comes home? What is it? Compassion. He didn't care. All that mattered to the father was, my son is, he's back. He demonstrates unconditional forgiveness to the boy. Because guess what? The father truly understood the boy's condition. Notice what he says. Twice he says it to both sons. He says it in verse 24 and again in verse 32. He says, "For this son of mine was dead and has come to life again. He was lost, and he's found." You see, the father is the only one that truly could see the children for who they really were. He's the only one that could really see that prodigal that went away in the condition that he really was in. And then he expected the same from the older brother. Notice verses 25 through 27. He has this feast for the other brother, and he honors the other brother. And then he says to the older brother in verse 32, "But we had to celebrate and rejoice, for this brother of yours was dead and has begun to live. He was lost and been found." In other words, that's the way the father expected the older brother to respond. He expected him to respond with compassion. He expected him to respond with joy in that his brother had come home. Instead, he responded with jealousy and angry. And the father expected the other brother to act the same. He pleaded with the other son. Notice the father showed just as much grace to the son, the older son, as he did the younger son. He came out of the feast. He pleaded with the older son for him to come in and accept his younger brother who had come back. He gently rebuked the older son in verse 31. He said to him, "Son," notice what he says in verse 31, "Son, you've always been with me, and all that is mine is yours. You've always been with me. I've always taken care of you. Everything that I have is yours. Why then this jealousy and this anger?" You know, the application, I think, for us as we think about the prodigal is, well, at least for me, it's many. Am I patient like the Father? Is my example like that of the Father? Or would my example be the reason the son didn't come home? How many children out there struggle with their relationship with God because their parents' example is just terrible? Are we forgiving like the Father? Are we close the way the Father wants us to be close? I'm going to read to you a quote. It comes from an author that was writing about the prodigal son as we begin to close. He said, "Our Western society is so deeply divided between these two approaches, moralism and self-discovery, that hardly anyone can conceive to live any other way. If you criticize or distance yourself from one, everyone assumes you have chosen to follow the other, because each of these approaches tends to divide the whole world into two basic groups. The moral conformists say the immoral the people who do their own thing, are the problem with the world, and moral people are the solution. The advocates of self-discovery say the bigoted people, the people who say we have the truth, are the problem with the world, and progressive people are the solution." And then Jesus steps into it with his parable of the prodigal son, and he paints for us a picture of a father, and he paints for us a picture of a kingdom that looks nothing like the world that we live in today. And then he extends that invitation to us via the gospel and says, "I want you to be a part of that kingdom." Look, church, look, Christian, if you don't feel like you fit in with the conservatives or the liberals in this world today, you're probably right where you need to be. Because the kingdom that Jesus came to set up isn't of this world. It never has been. He's not trying to set up the perfect kingdom in this world. He's called us into the Father's house. And so the invitation to us is, let's get right, church, and go home. Let's be in the Father's house. And so we have this parable of the prodigal son, and it forces us to look to the Father, right? It forces us to wrestle with what it means to have a relationship with the Father. It invites us to come into His house. It invites us to be a part of His family. Whether you're the son who's just been, grew up in the church, but somehow your relationship with the Father is stale and cold and hard, or you're the son that's a prodigal that ran off, this parable invites us all to just come in and rest in the Father's house. What a tremendous parable. Again, I go back to the idea that we started with, and that is, have you ever been lost before? Have you been in danger before? You remember that feeling when you got found? Or that feeling when you knew the danger had passed and you were going to be safe, the relief that you have? This morning, do you have that relief being in the Father's house? You know, the invitation for us is, if we are in the Father's house and this sermon strikes a chord with us and we realize that my relationship with the Father isn't what it should be, realize that He's not a God to just keep you at a distance. He wants you to come in and work on the relationship. He may be reminding you this morning, have you not always been mine? All that I have and all of my inheritance is yours. Come, come in. And if you're the prodigal this morning, He has cast out that invitation to you. He's waiting. He's waiting to run and meet you along the road. He's ready to take you back. And Jesus has told us what we must do. We must be willing to believe in the Father and to confess Jesus as Lord before others. And when we are immersed into those waters of baptism and we are raised to walk in a newness of life, it's not just that our sins are forgiven. We have a relationship with the Father. We've been added into the Father's house. And so this morning, as we extend the gospel invitation and as Eddie comes up to lead us in this song, I would ask you, do you need to respond to the invitation this morning? Do you need the prayers of the church for the elders to stand up and talk with you? Is your relationship with God what it should be? Are you lost in that far country of sin and you just happen to find yourself in here this morning? If you are this morning, please come home. We're ready for you to come. If there's anybody that needs to respond, won't you come as we stand and sing?